The desert can be surprisingly, well, green in places. Life blooms with the smallest pool of water. And when you're driving down the highway in southern Arizona, sometimes you drive right through a field so green, you'd think you were in coastal California. That can feel a little counterintuitive when you're hearing about climate change and water cutbacks every day on the news. But there are a lot of reasons why those green fields are here in the desert, and one of them is pure economics.
You can't expect farmers to go out on a limb and change everything that they're doing and implement these practices and produce all of this stuff with absolutely no guarantee that there's going to be somebody to buy it. Largely, they're growing what they're growing because not only is there a guaranteed market for it, but there's also guaranteed subsidies for it if it doesn't go well.
That's Anastasia Raven. She owns a small farm in a desert community. And she says she'd like nothing more than to be part of a sustainable food culture. But it's hard for her to see a way to make that possible.
We've gone so far down this road to where we're at and where we're headed that going back from it with people's habits entrenched the way they are and so many systems in place that make it difficult to change. I just don't see how we're going to get out of it.
I'm Megan Myskowski, and this is Tapped, a podcast where we tell our stories, the stories of people living with the cost of drought in the Southwest, and what we can do to mitigate it. On this episode, Arizona is built on agriculture. But as water dwindles, how is that industry adapting? And how much can it afford to change?
Let's go out. Come on. Come on, buddy.
Raven lives on a 160-acre farm in the Douglas Basin. It's a rural area about a 2-hour drive from Tucson. And there's a border checkpoint down the street from her. It's a bright, windy day in the spring. Dust is blowing in the air, and there are even dust devils running through the fields. Raven shows me her turkeys, a few dogs, horses, and some goats. She says those goats used to be working goats.
Do you remember that, Chicky? When you were a milk goat?
But that experiment didn't last.
It's really hard to think long term and decide to invest in a place where there's so much uncertainty about what could happen, like whether your well's gonna go dry or, you know, an earth fissure's gonna open up and like half of your freaking house is gonna fall into it or whatever it is. Or, you know, somebody's going to move into the field across from you and start running a pump that completely destroys, you know, the quality of life and value of your property.
We go inside to get out of the wind. Raven wears a lot of hats, both literally and figuratively.
I do whatever I can to get by out here. So I've done a lot of different things. I've produced food for people. I've done some editing. I sell auto parts on eBay. Whatever it takes to get by.
She also has a degree in natural resource management and rangeland ecology and management. She bought this land about 10 years ago.
Most of it is just in, you know, its natural degraded state of being some sort of pasture, rangeland.
At that time, she didn't have any animals.
And I was doing some things to cover bare spots on the ground and try to get vegetation growing again, and actually came up with some pretty good strategies for doing that.
And that was going well. So she brought some goats and some other animals into the picture.
I did not come here, I will say, with any intention to produce food for people in Tucson. I was not acting out some agrarian fantasy.
But she started to make a few things for herself.
Goat cheese and whey-fed pork.
And then, you know, I had like some lard and different animal products.
And she had very particular ideas about how the things she was doing, like raising animals, making cheese, and butchering, how they should be done.
I think it produces a great life for the animals, and I think that it's an environmentally sensitive way of producing food.
Some of the people around Raven took interest in the things she was making, and that's when the whole operation ramped up.
Some other work that I thought I had here didn't work out, and a relationship that I was in didn't work out, and so I found myself here alone, needing to figure out a way to make a living, and that's what I knew to do.
That's how a lot of small businesses get going. You start making a thing on the side, and some people around you catch wise and tell you it's good. You test it out on a few more, and once you know the customers are there, you get a truck, a booth at the farmer's market, a small catering business going. You move up little by little. But a few years after she started, she up and had to quit.
On a personal level, with the amount of work and lack of support in my day-to-day existence, and all of the stresses of other things going on around here, worrying about, you know, maybe my well going dry, it was just not tenable. I couldn't keep on doing it.
Her well hasn't run dry yet, but several of her neighbors and many people in the region where she lives have had to pay tens of thousands of dollars to deepen their wells or dig new ones altogether. And she doesn't have water rights attached to the property.
Water scarcity was never something that I was in denial of or didn't consider when I moved here. I figured a day would come when that would become an issue that might make it not possible for me to live here. I just didn't expect it to happen so fast.
Many in the area put the blame on a dairy and pecan farmers moving in and using the land in ways it wasn't meant to be used. Mostly they're using lots of water, digging deeper than the residents and small farmers who were already here, and literally changing the landscape. Drought conditions are also putting a huge strain on the land here.
In the past couple years, the lack of winter rain and really not fantastic summer monsoon rain happening right in this spot, really powerful spring winds, heat, which I don't think it's been so uncharacteristically hot here per se, but a lot of land disturbance going on all around with the bigger farms coming in. The dust storms, the blowing sediment flying through the air, getting deposited everywhere, literally burying parts of my property, my house, my windowsills, my fence line. It's been really overwhelming.
She says being a small farmer with an investment in the community feels like moving against the grain, and it wasn't sustainable for her to keep going.
It can be easy to idealize this different kind of agriculture that we could have. I mean, I myself would love to see things go that way.
Let's go back to that moment in your car. Maybe you're driving through an alfalfa field in central Arizona, or you're on your way to San Diego and you hit Yuma. Lettuce fields and pecan groves are on either side of the road. You hear a story on the radio about how Colorado River water is dwindling and cutbacks are coming. And you say to yourself, why is this here? Jeffrey Silvertooth researches agronomy and soil science at the University of Arizona, and he gets why you'd ask that.
That's one of the most important aspects of this discussion, I think, for us to remember, for particularly folks that aren't working in agriculture, as they consider, why are we growing these crops? Why do we have this legacy of these crops that consume this water? It's also because we do very well with those crops, because they're well adapted, they have markets.
To understand why agriculture looks the way it does today in Arizona, we have to go back to the 19th century. When the U.S. was settling the West, it created organizations to bring more agriculture here. That included the U.S. Department of Agriculture and land-grant universities like the U of A, which relied on income brought in by land stolen from Native Americans.
In Arizona, the desert Southwest, they began extensive, just kind of random studies to try to find crops that were well adapted, and also too had a market where you could actually grow them productively and people could make a living and demonstrate that for people to encourage settlement.
Their takeaway? That you can grow just about anything in the desert. The old joke is that you can put a stick in the ground and water it and it'll sprout roots and leaves.
The principal crops that were identified as being viable for this region are the ones we're growing today: cotton, wheat, barley, alfalfa, corn, etc. Each of them fits seasonalities that are well suited to Arizona. They tolerate the heat, they tolerate salinity.
These crops also need a lot of things beyond water from the sky that Arizona is good at providing.
So you have beautiful soils, you have access to water, you have infrastructure to deliver that water, you have expertise in terms of producing those crops, which is highly specialized.
And there's another big one that George Friswald, Silvertooth's colleague in agricultural and resource economics at the U of A, says you can't underestimate. And you can find it in the center of the Arizona flag.
You've got year-round sun.
As we learned in the last episode, irrigation has always been a part of farming in the Southwest.
So for example, you know, a lot of the Midwest, it's rain-fed farming. They don't have irrigation systems, so it's whatever falls from the sky. So if you have a drought, it doesn't rain like the normal amount of rain in the summer. Corn yields go down a lot. Wheat yields go down a lot. Cotton yields go down a lot. There's been years in Texas where 2/3 of all the cotton acres were abandoned. Like they planted the crop and didn't even bother harvesting.
And there's already a market for what we're growing here. It comes down to that moment when you're at the store planning what you'll eat from week to week. You expect to see lettuce there in the wintertime. The grocery store knows you'll buy it. And Arizona grows almost all of the country's winter lettuce. Like Anastasia Raven said earlier, there's no guarantee for them that you'll start eating tepary beans instead. And even though the federal government provides subsidies to farmers, which covered about 40% of income to farms in 2020 and 20% in 2019, they only go to producers of a select few crops.
When growers are producing things, they think in terms of, you know, what income can you generate per unit water? So a crop that doesn't use as much water per acre might not generate much income. And that's what farmers care about. It's like, oh, I'm going to pay for my daughter's tuition. It's like, well, I'm going to grow something that's going to provide for that.
To put that in terms for those of us who aren't farmers,
I could drastically lower my, let's say, carbon footprint of commuting if I quit my job and I walk to the local fast food place and flip burgers. Oh, I wouldn't be driving. I wouldn't be commuting. It's like, oh, well, that doesn't really make very much money. That's not really a good economic option.
And he says, farmers here have learned to be more water efficient out of necessity. Water is expensive.
Throughout Western history, agriculture has been using, you know, less and less water and, you know, less and less land, and more of it goes to urban development. But we've gotten more efficient at producing things.
Still, the drying out of the region is starting to catch up with those efforts to cut back. And agriculture accounts for about 3/4 of the water used in Arizona.
How drought shows up in Arizona agriculture, it's not through lower yields, it's through fewer acres planted.
A lot of the state uses Colorado River water, and that water is drying up fast. The state's drought contingency plan kicked in this past spring, which cuts water to farmlands in Pinal County between Phoenix and Tucson. And there are more cuts coming soon.
Farmers have always been adapting. They're always trying new things. I mean, agriculture has this reputation of being kind of really old-timey and traditional, but folks are fairly innovative.
Back in late February, at the tail end of the winter lettuce growing season, I went out to Yuma. standing in a lettuce field and you can really, really smell the lettuce. It like smells like when you open up a fresh bag of lettuce out here. That's me on Corey Mellon's farm. Mellon's a third generation farmer, and he walked me through how the lettuce gets harvested while we watched his employees in action.
On the backside of his knife, there's a small round knife, and it's called a coring knife. And he'll turn the head lettuce upside down and he'll pop it, which pops the core about that deep out of it, the part nobody wants to eat.
We moved on to another field where there are rows and rows of identical heads of spinach.
We take irrigation water from the Colorado River. Our district distributes it through the canal system that runs through the valley. They put it in our canal system at a gate and we control it from there. This particular field is overhead sprinkler irrigation.
He grows a lot more than spinach here.
So we're about 6,000 acres. We grow lettuce, broccoli, cauliflower, romaine, and then we do a lot of the baby products, your spinach, your arugula, mizunas.
And his operation is pretty high tech, which, like Friswald said, isn't unusual around here.
We utilize all laser control, land leveling in between crops to where when we do flood, it's as fast and as rapid as you can. We use all GPS technology to make our rows perfectly straight, and that's not just for aesthetic reasons, that's for accuracy reasons. Because when you irrigate a field, if that furrow's straight and it's deep and it's the right depth, you can get that water to shoot across that crop just as fast as you can.
He's also doing furrow irrigation and has experimented with drip, but didn't see a big difference between that and the sprinklers. Mellon says that in the 76 years this farm has been in his family, it's seen a lot of change, especially with the way water gets to the crops.
My father and those before me, a lot of them would irrigate different ways than we do now. You know, a lot more flood irrigation. If the crop was coming in too fast, they would irrigate it. If it was coming in too slow, they would irrigate it.
Big difference between his farm and the cotton growers in Pinal County is that this area's rights to Colorado River water are a lot more secure. The river is just down the road at the California border, so the farmers here have been using it for a long time and have seniority. But drought is still on Mellon's mind.
We treat water as any other input item in a crop. The least amount of water we can use, the more profitable we'll be. So we've been driven for years to reduce those rates of water that we're using to the bare minimum just to get the crop off that's acceptable and has a good shipping life for the consumer.
And he says sometimes it's a little strange to drive through Phoenix or Tucson and see pools and sprinklers and grass lawns.
And the question that I guess I've had is we've been systematically using less and less water and producing more and more crop with that water input. The city of Phoenix, the city of Tucson, you know, we've got to look at the system as a whole and what is being done at the city levels to reduce water as well, which there's things being done, no doubt. But what can we do to reduce that even more? And then the question has to be asked, how many people can live in a desert and sustain what they're used to with the water that we have at this point?
We're going to try to answer his questions over the next couple of episodes. But before we get there, we need to talk a little more about what Arizona farmers are doing and what's left for them to do. Robert Glennon has written and given a lot of talks about this. His book, Unquenchable, is about the U.S. water crisis and what he thinks could ease the pain of it. He's now at the College of Law at the U of A. He spent a lot of time in Yuma and been impressed by the massive operations and numerous trucks that bring lettuce to just about every corner of the country in the winter.
That's not going anywhere, nor should it go anywhere, because it's one of the success stories. Could they make some improvements in how they irrigate? Yeah, they could.
Again, a lot of farmers in these areas like Yuma have senior water rights.
And what the law in the American West has allowed is a limitless number of straws in a single glass. It's what you economists would call it, the tragedy of the commons. It's a public resource, water, that's finite, but you allow finite access to it. The senior appropriators were in a position where they really didn't have to make any compromises.
And he thinks farmers could make a few more compromises.
There are some things they could do to use less water, such as subsurface drip irrigation. I'm a big fan of that.
He also says they can't do it alone, and they don't necessarily have to. The United States Department of Agriculture has several programs to help farmers in this, and Biden's Infrastructure Act passed at the end of last year offers money as well. The Arizona legislature also passed funding this year for it, but he says more help should be on the table.
The Colorado River is in terrible shape across all seven basin states. The level in Lake Powell has never been so low since they first started filling the dam in the 1960s. Lake Mead is already that low. They're not crying wolf, the cities, and saying we need some water. So how do they get the water? Well, I think a pretty straightforward solution is for a city or a state to put together a fund to modernize farm infrastructure.
He says farmers could grow as much product as before, and cities would get the conserved water. And he says a little can go a long way.
And there's not a farmer in the West, Megan, who can look me in the eye and say, Robert, we can't do a small reduction. I'm talking low single digit. I'm talking 4 or 5% reduction in consumption. Because a 4 or 5% reduction in consumption translates into a 50% increase in the amount of water available for municipal and industrial consumption. 4 or 5%.
It's in everyone's interest, whether it's Raven and our goats or Melon on the leafy green farm, to find new solutions to the problem. But like Melon says, they're not the only ones competing for the water. So what are the cities doing? On the next episode, we'll start to get into that.
Because we've had generations of Tucsonans who grew up thinking that there's not supposed to be water in the Santa Cruz River, right? So they've grown up thinking the river is a dry wash. But that was not the case for thousands and thousands of years, right? The river was supposed to have water downtown Tucson.
But the water came back with help from the city and some researchers. This episode of Tapped was reported, written, and hosted by me, Megan Myskowski, with production help by Liz Cherfius and Nate Huffman. Duncan Moon is our editor. Christopher Conover is our news director at AZPM. Zach Ziegler is our production engineer, and JT Thorpe is our fact checker. The music you're listening to is by Michael Greenwald. Visit our website at azpm.org/tapped for pictures, links, and more.
This episode of Tapped was supported by a grant from The Water Desk, an independent journalism initiative based at the University of Colorado Boulder's Center for Environmental Journalism.